welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Haematology. This podcast aims to bring you expert perspectives on the burden and clinical presentation of pyruvate kinase deficiency, as well as current and emerging therapeutic strategies. The discussion is guided by questions submitted by a pre-canvassed community of healthcare professionals involved in the management of patients with pyruvate kinase deficiency. Financial support for this medical educational activity has been provided to Touch IME by an independent educational grant from Agios Pharmaceuticals. This activity is jointly provided by USF Health and Touch IME.
Hello, my name is Dr. Rachel Grace, and I'm a pediatric hematologist and clinical researcher at the Dana-Farber Boston Children's Cancer and Blood Disorder Center. And I'm an associate professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School in Boston, Massachusetts, USA. It is my pleasure to welcome you to this discussion on navigating pyruvate kinase deficiency today. How can the disease burden and unmet treatment needs be addressed? I'm here with Dr. Hani Alsamkari, a hematologist and clinical investigator at the Massachusetts General Hospital and an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School in Boston, Massachusetts, USA, and with Dr. Ami Shah, a clinical professor of pediatrics in the Division of Hematology-Oncology, Stem Cell Transplantation, and Regenerative Medicine at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California, USA. I'm going to walk us through the agenda for our discussion today. First, we're going to be talking about our current understanding of the burden of disease and clinical presentation of pyruvate kinase deficiency. Next, we'll talk about therapies that are currently available for pyruvate kinase deficiency and remaining unmet treatment needs. And then lastly, we'll talk about potential novel and emerging treatment approaches for patients with pyruvate kinase deficiency. So let's talk first about our current understanding of the burden of disease and clinical presentation of pyruvate kinase deficiency. Pyruvate kinase deficiency is a rare congenital hemolytic anemia with a wide range of symptoms and complications. Red cells lack a nucleus and rely on glycolysis for their energy source or for their ATP source. Pyruvate kinase is the key enzyme in glycolysis and an ATP-generating step. The final step of glycolysis is with the conversion of phosphoenolpyruvate to pyruvate. With a deficiency of pyruvate kinase, there's a lack of conversion of phosphoenolpyruvate to pyruvate, and this leads to a deficiency in ATP. And ATP is necessary for the red cell to maintain its membrane shape, to maintain the electrochemical gradient. And without ATP, the red cell lacks the flexibility and durability of the biconcave disc shape and readily hemolyzes. And this leads to the lifelong symptoms and complications of pyruvate kinase deficiency. Pyruvate kinase deficiency is rare, and the actual prevalence is unknown, but the estimated prevalence is on the order of 3 to 8 per million people. It's a condition that affects both males and females, and although it's a congenital or genetic diagnosis, the age of diagnosis can be quite variable because the symptoms are variable of pyruvate kinase deficiency, so this should be on the differential diagnosis for any patients who present with a hemolytic anemia. Pyruvate kinase deficiency is caused by homozygous or compound heterozygous mutations in the PKLR gene. And there are over 400 pathogenic mutations that have currently been described. Pyruvate kinase deficiency leads to a wide range of symptoms and complications and can negatively impact patient quality of life. Due to chronic hemolysis and an ineffective erythropoiesis, there's a wide range of symptoms and complications that patients with pyruvate kinase deficiency can experience. And these occur both in patients who receive transfusions and in those who don't receive transfusions and even have never been transfused. Some of these symptoms and complications are listed here, and I'll just highlight one of the under-recognized complications of pyruvate kinase deficiency is iron overload. And that can occur even in patients who are not transfused or have never been transfused. And so this is an important consideration and something that's very important to monitor for in patients with pyruvate kinase deficiency. In addition, these patients are at risk for low bone density and for gallstones, which are key complications to monitor for in patients. I'm going to turn over now to our panel discussion to talk more about the diagnosis and key symptoms and complications of patients with pyruvate kinase deficiency. And I'll turn first to Dr. Alsamkari. to talk a bit about who should be screened for pyruvate kinase deficiency and how is it best diagnosed? Is there an algorithm that you use for patients when you're seeing them in clinic who present with anemias? And what are the challenges with the algorithm or diagnostic evaluation that you consider?
Absolutely. Thanks, Dr. Grace. Great questions. Pleasure to be here with you. So, you know, in terms of who should be screened for PK deficiency, it's really any patient who has a hemolytic anemia of unclear etiology. I'm speaking from the perspective of an adult hematologist, right? And so, you know, my pediatric colleagues like yourself and Dr. Shaw tend to pick up most of the diagnoses before they get to me. But with PK deficiency in particular, because it's not something that everybody thinks about, I've actually made the diagnosis in patients who are in their 30s, 40s, 50s, which is kind of remarkable for a hereditary hemolytic anemia like this. If somebody comes to you and they have this unclear hemolytic anemia, it's really important that you move beyond the sort of typical testing that we do, looking for common things like autoimmune hemolysis and other acquired anemias and common hereditary anemias, and look for rarer things, right? Look for things like PNH, look for things like pyruvate kinase deficiency. That enzyme, PK enzyme testing, I think is appropriate to include in anybody who, you know, you've gotten through that typical standard battery of first and second line testing for the hemolytic anemia and you still don't have a diagnosis. I think the important thing to recognize is your diagnostic tools and the pitfalls of those tools. So I just mentioned PK enzyme activity. PK enzyme activity is not perfect. If somebody has received a transfusion of red cells within 60 to 90 days from the time you're checking the PK enzyme activity, it may be falsely normal or falsely elevated from those cells that came from someone else. Patients with PK deficiency frequently have high reticulocyte counts. And in that setting, the reticulocytes will raise, they have more PK enzymes. They'll raise the level of measured PK enzyme. And it's good to standardize that PK enzyme activity by also checking a hexokinase enzyme activity. And hexokinase, another glycolytic enzyme that is age dependent. And so thus dependent on the age of the cell. So it will be proportionally high in reticulocytes. So you can do a pyruvate kinase to hexokinase enzyme activity ratio. That can be helpful. But ultimately, we also want to get genetic testing in these patients. Oftentimes, enzyme testing is a good first step. It's not going to pick up everybody. I will always use a combination of both enzyme testing and genetic testing, exon sequencing of the PKLR gene in order to diagnose patients.
Thanks very much. I think, too, in terms of thinking about the pediatric presentations, just to add to what you had mentioned already about the adult presentations, I think it's important for people to recognize how babies or newborns might present. And then after birth, there's the common presentation of having indirect hyperbilirubinemia in the first 24 hours of life and needing phototherapy or even an exchange transfusion. But there's also presentations with pyruvate kinase deficiency in newborns that can be fulminant, can be very severe and be hard to recognize as presentations of pyruvate kinase deficiency. So these can be babies that have hyperferritinemia, have low platelet counts in addition to their anemia, have an enlarged liver or spleen, can have pulmonary hypertension or coronary disease. And so these are important to recognize in the neonatal period where there's a wider differential diagnosis, including metabolic diseases or infection. But rare anemias like pyruvate kinase deficiency need to be on the list and likely be diagnosed even with genetic testing at that time. So that's an important presentation also to recognize. For our second question, Dr. Alsimkari, again, what type of monitoring is important in patients with pyruvate kinase deficiency? And how do you think about the monitoring at different ages? And do you feel the monitoring should be different in patients who are transfused versus non-transfused?
That's an excellent question. For adults with PK deficiency, it's important that we screen for gallstones. It's very common for patients who have chronic hemolytic anemias, right, to have a biliary disease and gallstone disease. Patients who get splenectomies will often get a cholecystectomy at the same time. That's true for pediatric patients as well. In terms of other screening, it's really important to screen for iron overload. Everybody with PK deficiency should have screening for iron overload. If someone is not getting regularly transfused, you can get away with checking a ferritin once or twice a year. You can get a liver MRI for iron quantitation sometime in early adulthood just to see what the status is. If somebody is being regularly transfused, and especially if they're on chelation therapy, you know, we're looking at regular ferritin measurements every 3 to 6 months. We're looking at regular iron quantitation MRIs of their liver. We may also consider iron quantitation MRIs of their heart, depending on the patient and depending on the potential severity of that liver iron overload. Patients with PK deficiency, like patients with thalassemia, have a rather high rate of osteopenia and osteoporosis from very young ages sometimes. So I recommend screening at age 18 with a DEXA scan. You might think, wow, that's really early. By mid-30s, about three-quarters of patients have evidence of reduced bone density. So it's important that we pick up on this early. We encourage vitamin D and calcium supplementation, resistance exercise to build bone mass. And we shouldn't hesitate to use osteoporotic medications, even in our younger patients who have developed significant bone density decline. But that's kind of the sort of health maintenance and the kind of screening approach that I think of in adults with PK deficiency. A lot of that obviously relevant to kids, but happy to hear your thoughts as well on how you might do things a little differently in kids.
The same as what you've just listed is really true for children as well. I think one key difference with young children is that it's difficult to do some of the iron monitoring, like MRI, T2 star iron monitoring in young children, because sedation is needed for MRI studies. So if a child's not being transfused, we often wait until they're older to monitor iron in that way if we see that the ferritin is rising. Dr. Shah, I'd like to ask you the next question. If pyruvate kinase deficiency is suspected by a neonatologist or a primary care or non-specialist clinician, who should the patient be referred to?
Yeah, that's a great question for the audience. And as both of you and Dr. Alsankari have already discussed, PK deficiency can be challenging to diagnose. So in terms of really making sure the diagnosis is clear and they don't have false negatives, these patients really should be referred to either a pediatric hematologist, depending on their age, or an adult hematologist, so that the diagnosis is very clear and straightforward based on the enzyme activity as well as the genetics. And these patients, as you guys have both discussed, have a lot of complications that need to be monitored in terms of their iron, in terms of their infectious status, gallbladder. And so they need to be followed by a pediatric or an adult hematologist long-term in partnership with their primary physicians as well. These patients are rare. These patients are complicated. They can have a lot of different issues going on and everybody may not fit the same mold. So it's really important that they're followed in a comprehensive center.
Thanks very much. And lastly, I'd like to ask Dr. Alsankari, are there biomarkers that could indicate the clinical severity of PK deficiency? So as Dr. Shah mentioned, when patients are referred to a hematologist, including young patients, what can be explained, if anything, based on biomarkers for that patient that might influence treatment decisions or may help in terms of what we're all prognosis or complications to expect?
Yeah, excellent question. Thank you, Dr. Grace. So it's just as important here to know what things could predict more severe disease as what things don't predict more severe disease, right? So with an enzyme deficiency, you might think, well, the worse the PK enzyme deficiency, the worse the activity, maybe the worse the patient will be. And it turns out that that is not the case. Patients can have rather severe disease and their enzyme activity is measured only slightly below normal, and it can be really low and they may not have very significant hemolytic anemia. So it interestingly does often not correlate with the severity of disease. Thing that does, that certainly can, not for everybody, but certainly can, is the nature of their mutations. Non-missense mutations tend to, but not always, be more drastic in terms of phenotype. So patients who have two nonsense mutations may have a more severe phenotype. They may have a lower hemoglobin at baseline. They may be more likely to need regular transfusions and ultimately iron chelation than those patients who have two missense mutations. And people who have one missense and one non-missense will often fall in the middle. But one other thing I'll just say, just as a, I think an important note and something that's interesting and different about this disease, is just that hemoglobin does not necessarily correlate with symptoms between patients. Okay, so what do I mean by that? I mean, a patient with a hemoglobin, you have two patients with PK deficiency, have a hemoglobin of 8 at baseline. One of them is miserable, tired all the time, and needs regular transfusions. The other one's okay. But between patients, we don't have a threshold to say, oh, above 7 or below 7, we do or don't transfuse. It's really based on that patient's individual symptoms and the way they feel.
Thank you. I think that is very helpful. And I think, too, that it's important for families or patients who have a new diagnosis to understand that there's a wide spectrum in terms of what to expect. So just because they know one other individual with pyruvate kinase deficiency or their practitioner takes care of another patient, the two patients may be quite different, as you were just mentioning. We're now going to turn our attention to what therapies are currently available for pyruvate kinase deficiency and what are the remaining unmet treatment needs. Up until 2022, we mainly have had supportive treatments for patients with pyruvate kinase deficiency, and these have mainly been with the option of having blood transfusions and considerations around splenectomy. As we mentioned earlier, blood transfusions are considered in patients with pyruvate kinase deficiency really based on symptoms. So in young children, that can be effects on growth and development. And in older children and adults, thinking about how their anemia does or doesn't affect their everyday quality of life. And it's not with a set hemoglobin in mind that we make decisions about transfusions. And that certainly isn't the only factor. And there's not a specific goal hemoglobin or nadir hemoglobin that we're aiming for in patients with pyruvate kinase deficiency, kind of across the board applying to all patients. We also consider, especially in younger children around the age of 5, whether there's a role for splenectomy. Splenectomy in pyruvate kinase deficiency only partially ameliorates the anemia at best. So what I mean by that is that it raises the hemoglobin in the majority of patients, decreases the need for transfusions, or allows patients who were previously transfused not to be transfused, but doesn't typically normalize the hemoglobin. And after splenectomy, patients continue to have evidence of ineffective erythropoiesis and hemolysis and all of the associated potential complications. For some patients, splenectomy also isn't effective. Patients are the same, basically, before and after splenectomy. And those seem to be patients who have the most severe anemia and the highest degree of hemolysis. And so these both are important considerations for treatment and supportive treatment for these patients. And the roles for these supportive treatments continues to change over time as we think about new therapies, including disease-modifying therapies, which we're going to talk about in our discussion, like an oral pyruvate kinase activator, as well as a treatment with hematopoietic stem cell transplant, which hasn't been well studied in this condition. We also have other supportive measures for these patients, including monitoring, which we talked about earlier, as well as iron chelation for patients who are both transfused and non-transfused who have evidence of iron overload, considering cholecystectomy in patients with gallstones, oftentimes at the time of splenectomy, and considering the role of folic acid supplementation, particularly in patients with more limited diets. So I'm going to turn over to our panel again and turn my first question to Dr. Asim Khari. What are the key considerations when you think about the symptoms of patients with pyruvate kinase deficiency? And are there certain medications that you counsel patients to avoid who have pyruvate kinase deficiency?
Yeah, so thank you, Dr. Grace. So, you know, in terms of key considerations in treating symptoms, I think it's just really important that we don't minimize symptoms. I think it's important that we don't expect a patient who lives with a chronic anemia, any chronic anemia, to just have a reduced quality of life and have a reduced ability to do things because we don't want to start them on regular transfusions. I think the thing that I have just experienced most frequently in my patients with PK deficiency who, you know, have serious quality of life issues, they're essentially always happier once they started a regular transfusion regimen. So I think it's just, you have to ask about, you know, are you able to get through a full day of work? Are you able to get to a full day of school? You know, what are the things that are impacting you? It's in many patients with PK deficiency, it's not just the anemia symptoms, but the hemolysis manifestations, things like jaundice. I take care of a number of young adults with PK deficiency who, more than once I've heard them come in and say, just make me not yellow anymore. Right. And so when we have that kind of thing, because it significantly impacts their ability to have romantic relationships and social relationships, we really start thinking about disease modifying therapy. In terms of drugs that should be avoided, I mean, there's sometimes is a drug-drug interaction with PK deficiency and aspirin that comes up. This aspirin is okay to give patients who have PK deficiency who have an indication to receive it. It's not like G6PD deficiency where there's a whole set of drugs that can make the hemolysis much, much worse that clearly need to be avoided. So it's a different kind of pathophysiology there. It's not really an oxidant stress sort of condition. So it's really more about making sure that you use treatments, you use the treatments you have available to you when it's appropriate to use them.
Dr. Shah, what is your experience with allogeneic stem cell transplantation therapy for the treatment of pyruvate kinase deficiency? And what evidence do you use when you talk with patients and families about considering this treatment?
Thank you, Dr. Grace, for that great question. Allo transplantation has a lot of complications. And the first thing that we need to do is find a donor for these particular patients. Many patients with genetic diseases don't have sibling donors. So you're talking about doing an unrelated donor transplantation, which sometimes can be difficult to find a good donor. In addition, when we look at allo transplants, patients with pyruvate kinase deficiency oftentimes have significant iron overload, making their liver have some complications. And so when we talk about allo transplants, there are complications from the chemotherapy that can affect their liver. In the U.S., we don't tend to use allo transplants as a primary therapy for patients with PK deficiency. The Europeans have done some studies with a limited number of patients, but one of the complications that they've noticed is that patients will develop graft failure. And what that means is that the new stem cells don't work because they oftentimes are eaten up by the spleen, or they've developed complications from either liver toxicity due to the chemotherapy. So although it can be potentially used, it's not our primary therapy that we would offer to a family as one of the least complicated therapies that should be offered.
Dr. Alsamkari, what experience do you have using mitapivat, an oral pyruvate kinase activator, in your patients? And can you tell us about its effectiveness and the impact that you've seen on patient quality of life?
Absolutely, Dr. Grace. That's a really important question. I've treated close to 24 patients now with mitapivat of PK deficiency. In those patients for whom the drug works, which is, give or take around half of patients will have a significant hemoglobin improvement on mitapivat. It really, for most of those patients, I think life-changing is the right word to use. Because in many patients, in the patients for whom it works, the mean hemoglobin improvement is about 3.5 grams. And many patients normalize their hemoglobin. So in those patients who have a good response, it makes their jaundice go away. It makes their anemia symptoms go away. I've had many patients, tell me that they've never felt like, they never knew what normal felt like until they, had a normalized hemoglobin. So, this is a targeted therapy, revs up the PK enzyme. And in those patients who have mutations in their PK enzyme such that they're likely to be responsive to mitapivat, in other words, at least one missense mutation, and the missense mutation is not the R479H mutation, then it's certainly reasonable to try, and clearly improves quality of life as was seen in the randomized trials. And patients who are transfusion dependent may be liberated from transfusions and can enjoy many, many dramatic benefits as well.
Thank you. Have you seen safety concerns yourself, or are there safety concerns about mitapivat, and are there drug interactions that people should be aware of who are prescribing this medication?
Absolutely. So in terms of a safety concern, I think it's really important that patients don't have abrupt discontinuation of the drug, because then they can have rebound hemolysis, which was shown in a couple patients in the DRIVE PK study, the phase 2 DRIVE PK study. I think it's important that patients, you know, are monitored for potential adverse events. In the randomized Activate study, which looked at patients, receiving half patients receiving mitapivat, half receiving placebo, the overall adverse events profiles were relatively similar. The most common adverse events were nausea and headache in patients receiving mitapivat, and actually more patients in the placebo arm had those adverse events reported than in the mitapivat arm. So, it can cause side effects. Some patients can have complain of insomnia. Some patients can complain of heartburn. And these things are important to look out for. In terms of drug interactions, it plays well with most things. It's a cytochrome P450 34A inducer, a moderate inducer. So you just got to make sure most of the interactions are, monitored closely. But occasionally for certain, like HIV medications, for example, or antibiotics, it's contraindicated to for those things to go together. So just, do the micromedics check when you prescribe the drug. Beyond that, it just absorbs best when it's not taken with an antacid at the same time. So if somebody requires antacid therapy, in particular if they get heartburn, try to space out them using the antacid and try to use an H2 blocker or over-the-counter antacids rather than a proton pump inhibitor.
Thank you. Dr. Sean, thinking about mitapivat and the excitement around having a disease-directed therapy, what do you think are still the unmet needs for treatment in this patient population, both in children and adults?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And as Dr. Alsimkari alluded to, mitapivat is a great drug if it works on certain patients. Unfortunately, there's still a population of patients for which it doesn't work. We know that there's some genetic mutations that don't seem to respond to mitapivat. And if mitapivat doesn't work, unfortunately, we really need to think of alternative therapies so that these patients can live long lives. We need to think of a way to do transplants that are more effective. Obviously, we'll talk in the next section potentially about gene therapy as a potential option. We have to think about, for pediatric patients, about not taking out the spleen up front so that they don't have infectious complications for the rest of their life. So there's a lot of things that we need to improve upon. We're getting there. The fact that we've even have a activating agent such as mitapivat available and that's shown benefit to a lot of patients is really a remarkable first step. But hopefully we'll continue to build on that to provide other therapies.
Thank you. In our last section, we're going to be talking about potential novel and emerging treatment approaches for patients with pyruvate kinase deficiency. As a disease caused by a single gene defect, gene therapy is an emerging potential treatment option for these patients. And I'm going to turn over to Dr. Shah to walk us through how does gene therapy work for patients with pyruvate kinase deficiency.
Thank you, Dr. Grace. We currently have a trial available for gene therapy using a lentiviral vector to cure pyruvate kinase deficiency. And so I'm going to go through this slide, which talks about what is gene therapy, and then give you a little bit of results of some of the patients that have been treated with this. The first step is after a patient has been screened and that their organ function is good, then what we do is we collect stem cells from the patient's peripheral blood. And what that means is we give patients G-CSF to mobilize the stem cells. And then the patients are hooked to a machine similar to a platelet collection machine. And we were able to collect their stem cells, but still give you back your red cells and your platelets. Those stem cells are then sent to a manufacturing facility where they're able to insert their lentiviral vector with the missing PKLR gene into that. Once that is done, which takes about 4 to 6 weeks, the cells are shipped back to the site where the transplantation is going to happen. The patients are then rescreened to make sure that their organ function is good. And then they are given myeloablative conditioning, which is chemotherapy, with a drug known as busulfan. And people ask, why do we need to give busulfan? Patients with PK deficiency still make a lot of blood cells. And so that their bone marrow still makes a lot of red cells and white cells and platelets. And so we need to eliminate those cells so that there's a selective advantage for the new modified stem cells to grow. After they received 4 days of busulfan, a couple of days later, they received the modified stem cells that had been manufactured in the other facility that contains the missing PKLR gene. Those cells are infused. It looks like a blood transfusion. It's done in the hospital. And then the patients wait for their stem cells to grow, which takes about 2 weeks or so for the cells to start to grow. During that time, the patients will be monitored closely for side effects of the chemotherapy, and they'll remain in the hospital. They may still require blood transfusions until their new stem cells start to grow. Once the cells start to grow and they're doing well and they're eating well and they're having no infections, they're able to go home and we're able to monitor them as an outpatient. We've transplanted 2 adult patients with this therapy. Both patients received the gene-modified cells. They're both adult patients. And both patients had grafted within 2 weeks and have not required any blood transfusions after 16 days post the infusion of those new cells. The first patient was a female. She had not been on mitapivat beforehand, and she had had a splenectomy prior to this infusion. Having had a splenectomy was a requirement to being on the study. She's doing quite well. She's more than 2 years out from her gene therapy product, and she has not gotten any transfusions. Her bilirubin went from a level of about 11 prior to the gene therapy to less than 1. The second patient was a male who had tried mitapivat beforehand, and he hadn't had a response to mitapivat. He also has not gotten any transfusions after 2 weeks post the gene therapy product. He also has had a bilirubin of approximately 7.8 prior to the gene therapy. And after the gene therapy, he's also more than 2 years out, and his bilirubin is less than 1 now. They all have good signs of vector copy number, which means that the gene is present in their body. And they're both doing quite well. The study now is being moved to the pediatric population. And we hope in the future that we can try to do patients without having had a splenectomy, because as we talked about, taking out a spleen in a pediatric patient increases the risk of infections. And for us to be able to offer this type of therapy to patients before they are at higher risk of infections will be quite important.
Thank you for that explanation and for telling us about the patients who've undergone gene therapy so far. I'm going to turn my question over to Dr. Alsem Khare to tell us a bit about clinical research that's ongoing to assess mitapivat in patients with PK deficiency and how you think about this therapy in light of ongoing clinical trials of other treatment options like gene therapy. And are there also any other disease-modifying drugs in the pipeline that might be trialed in patients with pyruvate kinase deficiency?
Absolutely. Thanks, Dr. Grace. So there's already a very large for this disease, this rare disease, a large a set of trials in adults that have evaluated mitapivat in PK deficiency, the phase 3 Activate and Activate T studies. And really on that basis, the drug achieved FDA and EMA approval for adults with PK deficiency, but obviously kids have PK deficiency too. And so Activate Kids and Activate Kids T are the definitive pivotal trials in children. And those are ongoing now results very highly awaited and anticipated because, you know, right now this drug, which as we said, works very nicely for about half of patients with disease is technically limited to adult patients. In terms of other disease modifying drugs, there are other pyruvate kinase activators that are being developed, a drug called etavopivat, a drug called AG946. all of these drugs, both of those drugs are being developed for other hemolytic anemias and other anemias, things like sickle cell disease and myelodysplastic syndrome. Right now, they're not being trialed in PK deficiency, but in theory, right, they certainly could have effect and could be disease modifying in just the same way mitapivat is.
Thank you. I think it's an incredibly exciting time in terms of the treatments and development for pyruvate kinase deficiency. It's an amazing explosion of treatment options for patients. And I think, on the one hand, it's incredibly exciting. On the other hand, it's very difficult in terms of the decision making for clinicians about transfusions, splenectomy, transplant, mitapivat for adults, and even consideration of clinical trials and gene therapy and thinking about surgical options, medication options, or curative options. It's very difficult decision making, but extremely exciting. Wonderful to have these choices and to think about what the future holds for these patients in terms of having just a transformation of this disease and improving their lifelong outcomes.
Absolutely.
In your opinion, Dr. Alsamkari, how do you think these emerging therapies will help us to address the current unmet needs of these patients? And do you think gene therapy will provide a cure for patients with pyruvate kinase deficiency?
That's a great question. I mean, obviously, I can't see the future, but the data that Dr. Shah presented is remarkable. And, I think that for many patients, I have patients who don't respond to mitapivat and they feel left behind right now. Because there are other patients who respond beautifully and it's like they don't have the disease anymore while they're taking the drug. For those patients who don't respond, I mean, I think the potential for gene therapy is the most promising thing we have. Even just thinking about this, imagining a future where we have both PK activators and gene therapy, I mean, what a great problem to have if, you're a child, or parents of a child that has this disease and you're trying to figure out how to best address it. I mean, we've gone from nothing a few years ago in terms of disease modifying therapy, only supportive therapy and splenectomy and things like that, to now potentially having options for this rare disease, which that was inconceivable, I think, even just a decade ago. So I think that this is really an exciting time. I agree with you. And there's no doubts that that should gene therapy be successful, and it looks everything suggests it will be, that our patients, just benefit our patients, they'll have some great options.
I want to thank you both, thank the discussants for this very informative session. We've covered the diagnostic evaluation of patients with pyruvate kinase deficiency, thinking about the burden of disease, what monitoring is needed for symptoms and complications, considering current supportive treatment options and current disease-directed therapies, and then really talked in depth about emerging treatment options. And so I thank the audience. I thank you for your attention and for participating in this session.
Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on this and related topics on Touch Hematology at www.touchhematology.com. Do keep checking back for any updates as we launch further activities in pyruvate kinase deficiency.